This lecture, we're dealing with the Tower of Babel, and we're dealing with Nimrod and Naama, who came to be known later as Athena and Ishtar. There are some dark themes in this lecture, and I've done my best to keep this child-friendly, but we are going to be talking about, you know, some issues here that they apply. What they were doing back then applies directly to the problems we have today in our culture. So if you're really sensitive about it, in terms of your kids, you might want to pull them out. Okay. Yeah. Well, we got to deal with the world as it is, right? Okay. So, generations of heaven and earth, compendium of world history, and our purpose is to develop a biblically consistent history of the world. This is lecture number 3, from the deluge to the birth of Abraham. And these are the years 2348 B.C., which was the year of the flood, to 1996 B.C., which was the year that Abraham was born. So, review from last time, at the end of what I called Act 2, which was the flood story, you had a new creation of the earth, the world was made from water again. You had a new covenant with men and animals that God had made. You had a new environment and a new climate. You've got a new jurisdictional power, which is the power of kingship and capital punishment. You have a new law that every man shall now be his brother's keeper, and God is going to demand from every man the life of his brother, meaning that you better protect your brother instead of killing him. And we have a new fall, Noah's humiliation, which exposed his nakedness, just like the original fall exposed their nakedness, and a new curse where Canaan shall be his brother's slave. So, starting with this new period, what did Noah and his descendants do in the first century after the flood? Their first concern was raising children, and the Bible tells us about all the children that they had. They used the ark, apparently, to build their homes initially. They basically cannibalized the ark, and they probably brought a lot of materials through the flood in the ark, because any ship needs ballast, and in a world where you don't know where you're going, you probably want to take all the metal and heavy materials that you can with you. They began agriculture and hunting, and there's a lot of evidence of that in the area of eastern Turkey and Armenia. One thing is they were very interested in figuring out the new calendar, because the sun and the moon were now different from how they were before. There's extra days in the year. We've got seasons. The moon is going up high, down low. Basically, everything seems all messed up. So Noah, very early, was creating circles of stones, which like Stonehenge. They used those stones to study the stars and the sun and the moon and try to figure out what the orbits were and how, so they could predict, you know, when are the eclipses going to be, when is the equinox going to be, when should we plant our crops. So that was a major investment of their time. And then another thing is that they were very interested in surveying the new world. Now, we don't know what technology they brought through the flood, but we do know that they had technology before the flood. I'm just building an ark would have taken a pretty high level of technology. Can you imagine, to build a ship that big, you needed cranes, you needed levers, you needed to operate a crane, you would need power sources, maybe animals, maybe motors. So they had known how to calculate longitude. And you need to know how to calculate longitude in order to explore the world and make a map of it. Because if you can't figure out where you are on the surface of the world, then your map is not going to be accurate, right? So these are all things that they were studying. Now, we have records. We have the book of Genesis is apparently made up from tablets that Noah brought on the ark through the flood. We also have an Assyrian king named Ashurbanipal about 1,500 years later. He loved books and learning, except instead of books, they were tablets on clay and stone. And he was very proud of the fact that he had learned to read the language and he could read the tablets from before the flood. And he boasted of this. Even I could read the tablets from before the flood. So we know from this unbelieving king that there were tablets from before the flood, and he managed to get his hands on some of them. So these are some ancient tablets. Sometimes you can see from the size of this gold tablet, it's got writing on it in Sumerian cuneiform. It's so tiny it fits in the man's hand. they put their most valuable information on a form of writing that would not rot. So if you write things on paper and you have a fire, you lost your books. If you do it on clay and it gets dropped, it shatters into 1,000 pieces. But if you write it on gold, then you're good to go, unless you happen to get robbed by somebody who wants gold, and then they'll melt down your precious writing and turn it into, you know, jewelry or something. So anyway, so Noah brought through this knowledge in the form of tablets, and in addition to the Genesis tablets, evidently he also brought a lot of tablets that had information about technology and various kinds of technology, like metallurgy and basket weaving and making textiles and all these different things. And later his descendants fought over those tablets, and we have some stories about that. Second, we know that they started exploring the world using reed boats, because in southern Mesopotamia they had a lot of papyrus, and they started sailing around the world, and they would do rock carvings and drawings on cliffs, and they would draw their boats. And the Egyptians even buried their boats with the pharaohs, and so that some of them have been recovered. So this guy named Thor Heyerdahl, back in the 1950s, he made an exact replica of an Egyptian reed boat, and he sailed across the Atlantic from Spain to Barbados, proving that the Egyptians could sail wherever they wanted to. And then later in his life, he imitated the log boats. In the Pacific, they use log rafts off the coast of South America. And he built a log raft and sailed 8,000 miles from Peru to somewhere near Indonesia, proving that the ancients obviously had the ability to sail across the ocean. One of the records we have, the Sumerians, they called Ham the son of Noah. They called him Utu, and Utu was the name of the sun. They named him Utu, like as a title, because he sailed west with the sun, and he came back from the east as the sun rises. So what does that mean? It means Magellan was not the first guy to circumnavigate the world. Ham was. And later there was a Sumerian king about 1,000 years after this, who he imitated Ham, and he sailed around the world, and he recorded this as well, that he sailed into the west with the sun and came back from the east with the sun rising. Oops, what happened? I clicked on something I shouldn't have. There we go. Okay. As they were sailing around the world, sometimes they would make settlements, and one of these settlements has been found in the Orkney Islands in Scotland called Scarabray. And in this settlement, they had basically dug and cut down into the earth. They had a sod roof, but they had indoor toilets. They had plumbing. They had little shafts that took the waste from the toilet out away from the house, just like we do. They had high technology. They knew how to do this stuff. And as they went around the world, they did it wherever they went. Now, they made petroglyphs, and these petroglyphs apparently were like a universal language, and they would leave them where they went. Now, this is a petroglyph on the right. This is a petroglyph found in Armenia, and you see the symbol a lot. The symbol of the circle with the cross in it, that is the four quarters of the world. And these are Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the Bible says that when a man leaves an inheritance to his sons, he divides his land into the number of parts of however many sons he has, plus one. And that plus one is, well, his, because he keeps it during his lifetime. But when he dies, that plus one, that extra portion, gets left to the oldest son, so that the oldest son gets the double portion. So Noah, they were surveying the world because Noah intended to divide the world among his descendants. And so this idea of the four quarters of the earth, it does kind of come from the four directions, north, south, east, west, but it also comes from Noah dividing the world into four parts as the inheritance for his sons. This is interesting. So a lot of the church conception of Shem, Ham, and Japheth has been based on assumption rather than actual ancient pictures of people that tell us what they look like. So the typical Bible commentary will say Japheth was the father of all the Europeans, Shem was the father of the Arabs and the Middle Eastern people, and which is true, but it's not. He was father of more than just that. And that Ham was father of the Africans, and sometimes they'll say Ham was also father of the Chinese and the East Asians. And it's kind of weird how a lot of the older church historians are really wrapped up around skin color. Like they thought, well, Ham must be the father of all the people with dark skin. But you've got people in Indonesia who have dark skin who don't have the Negroid features that Ham had. You've got people in Central and South America with dark skin, and they don't have Negroid features. God made us to have several possible levels of melanin in our skin, and the melanin in our skin that makes us the color that we are adapts us to the region where we live. So if you live at the equator, you've got really high ultraviolet light, and if you don't have a lot of melanin in your skin, you're actually going to age really fast. So when I was in Kenya, I stayed inside the whole time. But my friends who went out, no, I didn't really, but I wore a hat and I used sunblock. But my friends who didn't worry about that, they, white people, aged about 10 years worth in two or three years. And when you see a white person in Kenya who's grown up on the equator at the age of 25, they look like they're 40. And if you see an albino person, they also, the sun just breaks their skin down. Well, you have the opposite problem the farther north you go, because as you go more and more north, you don't get a lot of sunlight. And if you have black skin and you live up like north of Michigan, you don't get enough vitamin D, because sunlight hitting your skin is what gives you vitamin D, and melanin blocks that. So people who have dark skin, if they live in far northern climates, they're very likely to get bowel cancer, and that's a high cause of death there. So white people at the equator, skin cancer. Black people at the North Pole, bowel cancer. And skin color is the way that God adapts us to the place that he sent us to live. So now here's what's interesting. I don't think that Ham was the father of the Chinese or the East Asians. The evidence we have is actually that Japheth was the father of the Southern Europeans, which would be the Italians and the Greeks. And he was also the father of the Mongols, the Turks, and the East Asians, and a number of the tribes that later became the American Indians. These are Egyptian drawings of the four races as they perceived them. On the left, this is how the Egyptians drew themselves. Number A over there. Now, who remembers who was the founder of Egypt? Who's the forefather of Egypt in the Bible? Anybody? Starts with an M. Okay, his name is Mizraim. And so Mizraim was the father of Egypt, and the Egyptians portrayed themselves as black. Now, in section B, we have the Indo-Europeans. And what you'll notice is the Egyptians portrayed the Indo-Europeans. That person has Chinese eyes. It's kind of hard to see in this resolution. This is how Egyptians portrayed other Africans, so they're also black. And this is how Egyptians portrayed Middle Easterners, such as Elamites and Assyrians and Arabs. And you may not be able to see in this resolution, but that guy has blue eyes. So Shem was the one who was carrying the blue-eyed and fair-skinned gene, or fair-haired gene, and is probably the father of the Northern Europeans, even though we've always probably been taught that Japheth was the father of the Northern Europeans. I think it was actually probably Shem. But other than that, the historical commentaries are relatively accurate. Okay, so Japheth. There's a mummy found in Utah. This guy was 10 feet tall. I'm not saying this was Japheth, but the picture they drew of the mummy, he clearly had Mongolian features, and I suspect that Japheth probably looked about like this. Japheth probably looked like a Mongolian guy. So, let's see here. Shem is the father of a whole lot of tribes. Now, remember when Ham emasculated Noah, and Noah cursed his son Canaan, he then made Shem his heir. He said Shem will be basically the top guy. Now, Shem was probably the firstborn, and Noah was the priest of the world, when Ham emasculated Noah, the priest had to be uncut. That was always a rule, is to be a priest before God, the man had to be unblemished. So Ham was probably thinking he would become the high priest of the world. But instead, Noah passed that to Shem. And Shem got the double portion, and that's probably why Shem ends up, his descendants cover a huge area on multiple continents. From northern Europe to Assyria, the Middle East, Iran, the Celts and Gaels, which later we'll get into that probably two lectures from now. Part of the Chinese were Semitic from Shem. They were called the Chu, and they actually ruled China in the first millennium B.C. The Arabians, and in Mexico, a number of the tribes of Joktan, the grandson of Eber, they appear to have come across the sea, and Ophir, he founded Peru, and Peru even still has the name, Ophir is preserved in the name of Peru. And Yucatan, his name is preserved in the Yucatan Peninsula. And Jobab, his name is preserved in one of the tribes of the Choctaw Confederacy. So I think that the American Indians were basically a mixture of Semitic and Japheth, and that's perfectly consistent with what Noah prophesied, that the sons of Japheth would dwell in the tents of Shem. Yeah. Now Ham, he was the father of the Sumerians, who were the southern Babylonia, the Egyptians, which today are called Nilotics, who've come down further into Africa, the Canaanites, the Libyans. His son Put was the father of the Bantu tribes of Central Africa, and Cush, who were the Cush was partly in Arabia and partly in Ethiopia. And then you also have Polynesia and Australia. The Australian Aborigines were Hamites and still are. So we're told that in the days of Peleg, the earth was divided. Now, Bishop Usher wrote a wonderful history of the world. Unfortunately, he misinterpreted this passage. He assumed that meant in the days of Peleg, the tongues were confused. But that's not what happened when Peleg was born. That happened later. When Peleg was born was when they'd been surveying the world, and Noah divided the world as an inheritance among his sons. And the language, earth was divided, is using the same Hebrew that's used in Joshua to describe when the Israelites divided up the promised land and as an inheritance after they came into the land. It's the same exact words that are used. So God, through Noah, divides the world to the tribes, and then the tribes are told to go and settle their places. But then the rebellion happens. I guess we'll get to that in a minute. So the places that they were initially assigned are all relatively close in the Middle East. You see that Shem was in this area. The problem was Canaan, he apparently was given a much further area, and Canaan decided he was going to take Shem's place. And his brothers told him not to. This is recorded by the Jews. His brothers told him not to, and he didn't care. And he took the coast of the Mediterranean, which was actually part of Shem's territory. All right, here's another way of looking at it. Shem basically got the southern Middle East, Japheth got the north, and Ham got the far southeast. Okay. Now, what's interesting, the Babylonians called this group of leaders the Anunnaki. They called them the gods, actually. They said the original assembly of the gods were called the Anunnaki. Now, in Babylonian, Anu means heaven, Ki means earth, and Anunnaki means from those who came from heaven to earth. So there's an entire little cult subset of these guys who've recently written books saying, our forefathers were aliens. They came from outer space, and the Sumerians, and they built the pyramids, and the Sumerians had all this technology that they gave them. And all this was based on misinterpreting what Anunnaki meant. Now, in Hebrew, Anunnaki means those of the boat of Noah, Anunnaki. So which one is the correct interpretation? I think they both are. The Babylonians, they said that there were 8 great Anunnaki, and then the 50 lesser, or the 70 lesser Anunnaki. So who would the 8 great Anunnaki have been? Anyone want to guess? You are right. Who's that? What's your name? Louis. Louis wins the prize for that for today.
Yeah.
All right. So what else is interesting? So Noah apparently ruled as king with a council of 70 elders. And the Hebrew word for 70 is Sanhedrin. And from this we get the Roman word Senate. So our form of government was started by Noah. Except he's a king instead of president. What's this president stuff? Okay. So God had told them to go to their places, but then they rebelled. So the Tower of Babel was founded in 2233 BC. I'm going to read this passage to you real quick. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks, bake them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city, and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Indeed, the people are one, and they have all one language. And this is what they have begun to do. Now nothing they have proposed to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Now, what's interesting about this is this is an outline of the passage. Here we have another chiasmus in Genesis, and once again, it's ordered where the central passage is when God acts. And we see this over and over again as these stories come through. The center of the story is when God takes action. So God is the one who, they decide to rebel against God, and they're all busily doing their thing, and God lets it go. And it turns out that he let it go for 42 years. And then he came down to see. And he said, "No, I don't think you're going to do this." So many people have depicted the Tower of Babel. For some reason, it's popular to draw it as round. However, I don't believe any round structures have been found in the Middle East. They're usually pyramidal and rectangular. This is probably, this on the right, this is the remains of the ziggurat at Bor Sippa. Bor Sippa means tongues, and it's located 10 miles south of Babylon. It turns out that what you see there is actually a ziggurat that Nebuchadnezzar built. Nebuchadnezzar was 1,200 years later. But it turns out that on the foundation of this ziggurat, Nebuchadnezzar left an inscription. He actually made four copies of it, one in each corner, to make sure that this inscription didn't get lost. And he said, this was an old ziggurat, and they had built it for 42 years, and then they stopped. And then they scattered from there. So I have rebuilt this ziggurat, and I have dedicated it to the god Nebo. So a German archaeology team went, and they started excavating this thing, and they cut a shaft down through it, and they found inside Nebuchadnezzar's ziggurat an older one. And apparently, I don't know, I'm not certain if Nebuchadnezzar correctly identified it, but it seems that he thought it was the Tower of Babel, and he decided to devote it to his god. So this is probably the actual remains of the Tower of Babel. So how did this happen? What's the backstory on the Tower of Babel? Now things are going to get very interesting. As you recall, before the flood, we're given the line of Cain. We're told about Zillah, and she has a daughter named Naamah, and she has a son named Tubal-Cain. And Tubal-Cain became an instructor in all the metals. He was a metallurgist. Now, Zillah in Hebrew means very dark black, like shade. And of all the metals, let's see, who knows what color is copper? Any kids? What color is copper? Sammy?
Brown.
Okay. Would you say it's brownish, a little more? It's reddish brown, right? So copper is kind of reddish brown. What color is silver? Silver. What color is gold? It's gold. What color is iron? Cast iron.
Black.
In Hebrew, the word for iron is Barzillo, which means child of Zillah. Ham was also dark-skinned, and apparently he married Naama, who also was dark-skinned. So this is where the racial characteristics of Ham's descendants came from. And the Greeks depicted this. This is Ham, who they depicted him as Chiron, the Centaur. And here's him marrying Naama, who would later become Athena. Sorry about that. Okay, so this is a statue of her. This is how they depicted her later. Naama came to be known. She was the most famous person in the ancient world, and she may have been one of the most evil people who ever lived. She came to later be known and worshipped as Ishtar, Isis, Astarte, Athena, and Semiramis. She apparently became very bitter. Go ahead. Naama?
You know, Shem, Ham, and Japheth?
Mm-hmm.
Where does she come from?
Oh, she's in Genesis. She's descended from Cain.
Okay.
She's the seventh generation great-great-great-granddaughter of Cain.
She was on the boat.
She's on the ark. She was Ham's wife.
Okay.
Yeah. So the Jews say she was Ham's wife. Some people say she was Noah's wife. But we have enough info from the Greeks that she was definitely Ham's wife. Okay. That used to be a question mark for me. Now there's no question. She was definitely Ham's wife. So apparently what happened was Naama was very bitter over the destruction of the line of Cain. These were her family. She loved them. And her bitterness, she allowed that to lead her into despair and wickedness, specifically to rebel against Noah and Noah's God. Her later, as she began to rebel, she basically went to war against Noah, but not in the way a man would go to war by conking him over the head or killing him, but in subversive ways. She tried to lead. She was basically the power behind the throne that Cush and Nimrod and Ham all led the people away from the God of Noah to start worshiping the God of Cain. And she also, we're told by Ammianus Marcellinus, she was the first to begin the practice of making men into eunuchs. Now, remember Ham does something to Noah. Where did he learn that? Well, she apparently had that knowledge from before the flood. So it's interesting that Noah did not curse Canaan to destruction. Now, we get later in the Bible and God says, wipe him out. But Noah didn't say, Canaan shall be cut off. He said, Canaan shall be his brother's slave. If Canaan and Ham had repented, God's merciful. God is merciful. But instead, Canaan doubled down. And we have the record from the Jews. Five things that Canaan told his sons: love one another, love robbery, love lewdness, which is sexual immorality, hate your masters, and do not speak the truth. And this became the culture of the Canaanite territory later. So Canaan then, he proved that himself by taking the territory that had been allotted to Shem. He just took it for himself, which is the area that is now known as Palestine and Syria.
Isn't that American politics?
Yeah.
Okay. Those five things?
Right. So now here's where it gets interesting. So Naama is married to, this is, again, how the Greeks depict Ham. Obviously, he didn't really have a horse's back end. They're portraying him as one of the Centaurs. This is Hermes, or Cush, and he's carrying a little black baby. This is baby Nimrod. And he's holding a scepter, and it has two little snakes on the end of it. This is called a caduceus. And it says the symbol of his authority is the serpent. So he is fleeing from Ham. So even though Ham rebelled against Noah, Ham seemed to apparently want, his ambitions weren't so great as to completely reject God altogether. He just wanted to be, he thought it was his time to be high priest. He thought it was his time to rule. Whereas Naama was teaching these two, and she taught them to completely reject the God and religion of their father. So this is a Greek vase. This is, on one side you've got Ham, on the other side you've got Cush running away from Ham, carrying Nimrod. So what's going to about to happen is Cush was the first leader of the Babel Project, and Nimrod was the muscle. Nimrod was the mighty hunter. Now, here's something else that now starts to get kind of disturbing. So if we read in that passage of Genesis 10, it tells us who Cush's sons were. But it doesn't list Nimrod with his sons. The sons of Cush were Sheba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Sabteca, and the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. And then verse 8 says, Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. So why does it separate the begetting of Cush from his other sons? There's some evidence that the reason is that Naamah, apparently she wanted to bring back the line of Cain, not just spiritually, but as close as possible as physically. And she might have been trying to back cross herself with her own son. And that Cush apparently begot Nimrod with his own mother. And that's the Bible's kind of hiding that. But this is how rebellious she was, that all the rules were there to be broken. And we're going to later find out that Nimrod ended up marrying his grandmother. So she was doing this over and over again. Naamah is leading this rebellion from behind the throne, and she's using whoever the young man is, her son and her grandson, to execute her will. Now, the Bible calls him Nimrod. The Hebrew is actually a... they're playing on words, but we'll get there in a minute. So Nimrod was Naamah's hero. She trained him to become a warrior and to overthrow Noah and replace the religion of Yahweh with the way of Cain, which was the enlightenment of the serpent. And here, the way the Greeks depicted this, Noah is depicted as Nereus, who's the old man of the sea, or Triton. So he's depicted as the fish man, and he had his own scepter. And here's, he's holding the fish, sorry. The fish is like his little scepter. He's got a fish scepter. Yeah. I should get one of those. You know, because if someone's bad, you can bonk him with a fish. So this is Nimrod. He doesn't kill Noah. He wrestles Noah out of the way. And he replaces him. Over here, this guy in the background, that is the Greek Poseidon, waiting to step in and become the god of the sea in place of Noah. And Poseidon is the Greek version of Sidon, the firstborn son of Canaan. So, David Roll noticed in the Sumerian king list, in the kings of Uruk, there was a guy named Meshkiagasher, who's apparently Cush, and he has a son named Enmerkar. And in Sumerian, Enmerkar means Enmer the hunter. And Enmer means Lord Storm. And in Egyptian history, there's a guy named Narmer. And Narmer beats up all the guys who won't obey him in Egypt, and he conquers North and South Egypt and brings them under his rule. And Narmer, they both use the same symbol, a catfish and a chisel, to write their name. They're the same guy. So Nimrod's real name was Enmer, which means Lord Storm. So after the flood, you had rain for the first time, you had thunder the first time, and Naamah names, or whoever Nimrod's mother was, she names him Storm. And then once he got power, he became known as Lord Storm. This is the Narmer palette from Egypt, one of the oldest human artifacts that we have. So on the one side, that is Nimrod, or Narmer, he defeating his enemies in Egypt. On this side, he's got all of his enemies he's defeated with their heads cut off, and their heads are between their feet. This is his banner, and these are the Egyptian words for Narmer. This is the symbol of Ishtar, his wife / grandmother, the cow god. And this, what does this look like, guys?
Dinosaurs.
Well, they call them... serpopards, because they look kind of like a lion's head and they kind of have lion's feet, but they otherwise look like a brontosaurus. Not sure if it's a real dinosaur or if it's just like a figurative animal or not. This is the oldest human writing artifact in the world. It's from Kish, called the Kish tablet. And we have the same, we have Nimrod. This has his name on it, Enmer. So... he was real, And he was in two places. He was in both Babylon and Egypt. So Nimrod's religion was that man is the measure of all things, which is secular humanism and atheism. He's rejecting God. We're going to do it our way. We don't have to obey any of God's rules. Seek the enlightenment of the serpent. Establish order through chaos. And what they meant by this is they would their religious festival. Okay. Well, let me, God says you should do things this way. You should be sober. You should be fruitful and multiply. You should be married. A husband should have one wife, be faithful to her, and have children. Nimrod says the opposite. He says, not only are we going to do the opposite, we're going to make that our religion. We're going to get drunk and do things that we don't even talk about. Okay? But the result of this religion is they have a whole lot of babies being born, and they have no clue who the father is. All right? Child sacrifice. God said after the flood, I'm going to require from every man the life of his brother. And Nimrod says, well, you know, I think the gods would be really impressed by us giving our most valuable things. You know, so if you want to earn favor with the gods, sacrifice your firstborn child and eat him. And that's what they did. And so Molech, later you hear in Hebrew, the Molech worship was they were passing their children through the fire. Molech is from the Hebrew Melech, which means king. And it's a form of worshiping Nimrod, you know, through much later in history. And the third thing was that they believed they would build these temples on ziggurats, and in the temple, they would put young women in the belief that the gods would come down and sire offspring with them. And there's this debate, what were the Nephilim? Were they really angels having offspring with humans, or was it just the sons of Seth marrying the daughters of Cain? Well, the religion of Nimrod, they apparently really believed that this produced real offspring, and that these guys were gigantic giants. So, Nimrod, after the Tower of Babel was dispersed, Nimrod invades Assyria. Asher was Shem's firstborn son, and Shem had been resisting him. They hadn't come to all that war yet, but when the Tower of Babel was confused, you would think Nimrod would be like, okay, I did my best, I lost, God wins. But he refused to give up. So Nimrod goes into Assyria, and he builds the city of Nineveh to dominate Assyria because he wants to keep Shem's firstborn son, Asher, under his thumb, kind of like a hostage, but basically to keep Shem from rebelling against him because Shem was the most powerful leader who was against Nimrod. So we have two stories of how Nimrod was killed. According to the Georgian Chronicle, which is the people of Caucasia, which is Armenia and Georgia, Hake was one of the grandsons of Togarma, who was one of the sons of Japheth. Hake worshipped the true God and gathered the armies of the children of Togarma and fought against Nimrod. Hake shot Nimrod with an arrow and killed him. And then Josephus says Ham's black grandson Nimrod was beheaded by Shem. And other accounts say that Shem then cut Nimrod's body into pieces, and he sent the pieces to all the countries to warn everyone, this is what will happen if you continue in the way of Nimrod. Now remember, God had given capital punishment. Nimrod, he took up the sword, but he was in rebellion against God, and he took the lives of many, many men unlawfully. So Shem was the first leader after the flood to execute capital punishment, and he executed Nimrod. So Nimrod did not come to a good end. Now, at this time, Naamah, she has a baby about a year after Nimrod died. And she claimed it was the reincarnation of, she didn't say it's Nimrod's son, she says this is the reincarnation of Nimrod. And later, the baby was named Gilgamesh in Babylon, he was named Horus in Egypt. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, it says his father was a demon, and his mother was the goddess Ishtar. I believe Gilgamesh was the first of the post-flood Nephilim, and the Epic of Gilgamesh tells us his story. It says when he was king of Uruk, he established a policy where that whenever there was a wedding in his city, he got the first night with the bride. Just like in the movie Braveheart, which means that all the firstborn children of these families were his offspring instead of the offspring of the dad. And it's very likely that these kids were kicked out. And that's probably where the giants who are around the Dead Sea that we hear about later in Abraham's day there are these little tribes of giants living around the Dead Sea. Where did they come from? They very likely came as the offspring of Gilgamesh. So this is a picture of Gilgamesh. And kids, what is this in his left arm? That is that a kitten? It's a big lion, right? So if that's a lion, and you know how big a lion is? I've seen a real lion. A lion is about from this chair to, what's your name?
You.
Patrick. So from Patrick to here, that's how big a lion is. So if he's that big, and he's holding this little, this lion in his arm, how big do you think this guy is? He's at least 10 feet tall. Okay, this guy is huge. Well, what's interesting, though, is that Gilgamesh realizes he's going to die. And this became a theme, because after the flood, their lives were shortened. But the people from before the flood, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah, and Ish, and Naamah, they're all living, they all look healthy. They're living hundreds of years. But their descendants are clearly weaker and clearly going to live shorter, and they're aging faster. And so Nimrod becomes obsessed with the problem of his mortality. And so he goes, so Nimrod went, and he actually, there's Greek pictures of him robbing Noah's house. He's like going through all of Noah's belongings, trying to find the secret of immortality that Noah must know. Well, he doesn't find it and goes to his grave. Gilgamesh, who now has the same question, and whether or not he was an offspring of an angel or a demon or not, he is also obsessed with his mortality. So the Epic of Gilgamesh tells us the story of how Gilgamesh goes and finds Noah. He goes up to the land of Misha, and he calls it the land of the living. And he finds Noah, and he says, "Noah, please tell me the secret of immortality." And the Noah character actually says, "There is no permanence," which is to say, sorry, bud, nothing you can do about it. So he comes back, and then he dies. So when he died, that ended the world government that Nimrod had started. Now, Nimrod's world government only went from Egypt to Babylon up to Assyria. So it was kind of like a triangle in the Middle East. And it didn't really go further than that. But once Gilgamesh died, Abraham was about 32 years old when Gilgamesh died. That basically liberated the whole Middle Eastern area from under the rule of them. So Shem basically won. Shem outlived them all. And Shem defeated the people who had overthrown the god of Noah, or so they thought. So here's the chronology. So you have the year 2348, you have the flood. 100 years later, Noah divides the world as an inheritance to his sons, and that's the year that Peleg was born. 2233, Babel was founded by Cush and Nimrod, and the Babel lasted 42 years. In 2191, God confused the tongues, and the nations were dispersed. The same year, Nimrod invades Assyria and builds Nineveh. 4 years later, Mizraim founds Thebes in Egypt. And then apparently his sons were not willing to submit to Nimrod's rule. So Nimrod goes to Egypt where he's remembered as an armor, and he fights a little war to force them to pay tribute to him. And around 2068, Hake kills Nimrod, and Shem dismembers him and sends him out to warn everybody. Incidentally, Shem doing that made a very strong impression on everybody. So about 800 years later, a similar event happened in Israel where these Benjamites killed this man's concubine. And he wanted justice, so he cut her up into pieces and he sent the pieces throughout Israel, and everyone came together and said, "What is this?" This is where he got the idea. He was actually following Shem's example. So, according to the Egyptian legend, the Naamah character in Egypt was called Isis. They say that after Osiris, which is what they call Nimrod, after he was killed and dismembered, Isis went and collected all of his body parts from all the places that they'd been sent, and she puts them all back together so he can have, because they believe that you had to have your whole body together, or in the afterlife you would be tormented. So she gets all. She regathers all the pieces of Nimrod, and he's buried in Abydos in Egypt, and that's actually where his tomb was. It's still there. Go see it. Of course, they call him Narmer in Egypt. So then ISIS did something very interesting. For the next 25, 30 years, she manages to keep control over those three kingdoms, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon. And she changes the religion a little bit into a mystery religion. So they take Nimrod's religion and they turn it into a secret society where you have to be initiated to learn the secrets. And so on the outer view of it, you see like the Greek gods doing all these crazy things, these centaurs and people with dog heads, and you think all these are all just silly mythological characters. What it was is she was concealing the history inside of myth. So you had to become an initiate to learn the real story and be told what it all meant. So what she was effectively doing was founding what would later become, in our time, what we know as Freemasonry. Freemasonry is a form of that ancient secret religion that's celebrating Nimrod. In the Freemasons today, they call Nimrod Hiram, and they say that he died and then he rose again. So the interesting thing about this method is she's creating secret societies that secretly work behind the scenes to try to gain power and overthrow the worship of Yahweh in every country where they are. And they've been pretty much using that as their method ever since. So 1998 BC, Noah finally dies, and 2 years later, Abram is born. In 1994 BC, Naamah dies. And then 1968 BC, Gilgamesh dies. In 1968 BC, Shem becomes the Pharaoh of Egypt. And he's actually in the Egyptian king list as Semkare, or Semsem. And the Greeks remember him as Semsemsis. And there's a picture of him. Let's see if I can find it. Actually, I guess that was back earlier in the slide deck. I had the little cartouche. There's an Egyptian carving of Shem, of an old man with a long white beard holding a staff, and he's got a straight, very straight nose, just like Doug Wilson. So Doug Wilson may be the spitting image of Shem. So the characters at Babel, they're remembered by the religion that Naamah started, effectively became polytheism. And you have the same sets of gods, but because of different countries having different languages, they're worshipped under different names in every country. And then if one country conquers another country, they impose their gods in that country. So now that country is worshipping both. And what happened is you effectively multiply. All the gods get doubled. There's now two versions of them. So you would see this like in Canaan. The Canaanites were worshipping Nimrod as Baal, but they were also worshipping him as Molech and Adonis and Tammuz. All these different names are names that they use for Nimrod. So Ham, the Greek name for him, Charon and Cronus, Egyptian Ammon, the god Ammon, Babylonian, he was named Utu or Enki. Cush, to the Greeks, is Hermes and Apollo. He was the speaker. He was the public speaker. He was the politician, and Nimrod was the muscle. Father-son team. Egyptians called him Thoth, who created writing. And he may actually, after the Tower of Babel was confused, it may have been that he designed the pictures so they could talk to each other, and those pictures in Egypt turned into Egyptian hieroglyphs, and in Babylon they turned into cuneiform, and in China they turned into Chinese. So Horus is not mentioned in the Bible, except as the heroes of old. But the Egyptians called him Horus. The Babylonians called him Ninias, as well as Gilgamesh. Naamah is called Athena by the Greeks, Isis by the Egyptians, Ishtar by the Babylonians. Sidon, who's the son of Canaan, he is remembered by the Greeks as Poseidon. Heth, who's also a son of Canaan in the Bible, he is remembered by the Greeks as Hades, and by the Babylonians as Hadad. So that's pretty much where polytheism came from. And that explains to you why the God of the Bible was so zero tolerant of this, the worship of these foreign gods, because they weren't just worshiping something they believed in. Their religion was breaking all the laws of Yahweh, turning sexual morality upside down, doing practices that resulted in no one really knows who the father of these little boys, these babies are. So therefore, who's going to raise them? So review the chronology. So for the first 60 years after the flood, they're focused on exploration and studying the heavens, learning what's going on with the new sun and moon relationship. 100 years after the flood, they're dividing the earth as an inheritance. Babel rebellion lasts 42 years. The Greeks call it Clash of the Titans. After Babel was dispersed, the next basically 200 years is the struggle between Shem and Nimrod, Naamah, and Gilgamesh. So that's the Greeks called that Clash of the Titans. And then God calls Abram in 1921 BC. That's when he calls him to come out. So now we're at the end of Act 3, actually, not 4. The tongues are confused at Babel. The nations scatter. Nimrod persists in trying to keep the world empire. Nimrod fails. Shem executes him, or at least dismembers him after Hake shot him. Noah dies, and Abraham is born, and he will be the new hope. And that ends Episode 3.